Today's Veterans Radio program is dedicated to all of those veterans who fought during the Battle of Iwo Jima.
All across America and around the world, you're listening to America's number one program for veterans, Veterans Radio. And now, live from the studios of WDEO in Ann Arbor, Michigan, here's your host for today's program, former Chief Warrant Officer, helicopter pilot with the 195th Assault Helicopter Company, Republic of Vietnam, 1969, Dale Throneberry.
And good morning, America, and welcome to Veterans Radio. Today's program is I'm really excited to get into it right away. We're going to be talking to the sons and daughters of Iwo Jima veterans to find out how the battles at Iwo Jima in 1945 affected not only their fathers' lives, but also their lives going forward. I think it's a rather interesting. I found that there's a large group of people out there that are sons and daughters of Iwo Jima veterans, including myself, which I'll get into in a little bit. But that's what we're going to be talking about today. We're also going to be talking with the founder, or not the founder, but the executive director of the Iwo Jima Association of America, to talk a little bit about that organization. Our welcome home, Medal of Honor, at the bottom of the hour, you want to listen to that, because we're going to be listing and talking about each of the Medal of Honor recipients from the battle on Iwo Jima Island. It's a really an interesting fact out there that there are 27 of them, and Marines and Navy personnel, and there were only 80 some Medal of Honor distributed to Marines during the whole of World War II, and over 20 of them came from Iwo Jima. I'm really excited to talk about that as we go forward with that also. Running our board today is Matt Durr. Matt, good morning. Thank you.
Good morning. Pleasure to be here.
And trying to run the webcast with all of the photos. We got hundreds of photos today. If you are watching on our webcast, is my partner, Gary Lilly, CB.
Hey, good morning. CB, can do.
I hope so. Which reminds me, I got an email this morning from a CB that said, don't forget the CBs on Iwo Jima. I said, okay, we'll have to, when I get Diane on the line, we'll have to talk a little bit more about that as we go forward. But first of all, I want to bring up on the line right now is Sean Jaros, who's the executive director of the Iwo Jima Association of America. Sean, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Dale.
How are things where you are?
That's pretty nice out today.
I hope so. Spring will arrive. We know that at some point. Tell me a little bit about your association, Sean.
Well, it was basically founded by General Fred Haynes, and it was originally the combat veterans of Iwo Jima. And as these gentlemen started getting older, General Fred Haynes wanted to include the family members, the legacy members. So our mission is to educate about the war in the Pacific, and we want to ensure that the legacy and what happened out in the Pacific is not forgotten by this generation.
Well, that is surely true. And people can join, because I know you already sent me an application. You said I'll become a member, probably along with our other guests today. And I noticed that there's a lot of great information on your website. Could you give that address out to our audience?
Yes. If you are interested in becoming a member, the cost of membership is only $25 a year. And our website is www.iwojimaassociation.org, and we are constantly updating our website. We're getting ready to we just got done with our 66th anniversary reunion and symposium, so we're going to get ready to download all of those pictures that we took, and next month we will be heading out with veterans to the island of Iwo Jima, and we'll be posting those pictures as well.
Well, I think it's a great thing that you're doing, Sean, and I want to thank you on behalf of all of the children of Iwo Jima veterans for keeping this site up, and I know that I've got some pictures I want to send off to add to your collection.
Okay.
And people can just go on to your website, which is iwojimaassociationofamerica.org, and there's all kinds of great information there, and we want to thank you so very much for being on Veterans Radio and supporting all of the things that veterans do. So thank you, Sean, very much, and we'll get back to you and get some more people on here about Iwo Jima.
Thank you, Dale.
All right, thank you. As I mentioned, we're going to be talking with the sons and daughters of Iwo Jima today, and we're going to be doing that right after we take our first break. But first, we always have our Welcome Home segment. And this week on Veterans Radio, we are welcoming home all of the men and women that are coming home from around the country. We're so grateful for all that you are doing to protect us and protect our freedoms and to protect our lives. And we're hoping that someday that we're going to be able to drop this segment and not have to welcome home troops coming from around the world. Welcome Home is brought to you by Ave Maria University, by the Marine Scholars Fund, and you need to go to avemaria.org for more information.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
You buy, I'll bring you victory. Buy, 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 buy a bond, and you'll be standing by the victory.
And we're back on Veterans Radio, and we're talking with the sons and daughters of Iwo Jima, and I want to just read a little bit off of a email that was sent to me about the Battle of Iwo Jima, which took part in February and March of 1945 and was marked by some of the fiercest fighting of the entire war. The American invasion, known as Operation Detachment, was charged with capturing the airfield on Iwo Jima. We were getting closer and closer to Japan. The Imperial Japanese Army positions on the island were heavily fortified with vast bunkers, hidden artillery, and 18 or 11 miles worth of tunnels. The battle was the first American attack on the Japanese home islands, and the Imperial soldiers defended their positions tenaciously. Of the 21,000 Japanese soldiers present at the beginning of the battle, over 20,000 were killed, and only 216 were taken prisoners. During the two-month-long battle, 27 U.S. military personnel were awarded the Medal of Honor for their actions, and I'll get into that a little bit later on. This is possibly one of the bloodiest battles in the Pacific to end World War II, and I want to start bringing on our guests, and I'm going to try and bring you guys on one at a time. So I'm going to start off with Joyce. Joyce Faulkner, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Hi, it's very nice to be back. How are you?
I am terrific. Joyce Faulkner is the author of In the Shadow of Mount Suribachi, or Suribachi, not mountain, that one. And your dad was in what service?
He was a Marine, and he was a very young Marine. He had just turned 19 two days before the battle began.
Right, and your dad's name was?
Bill Plummer.
Billy Ray Plummer, right?
Billy Lee Plummer.
And we've got some pictures of Billy Ray that we're going to be trying to show up here on the webcast as we go along. And Joyce, I'm going to have you hang on the line. Actually, I think what we're going to try and do, Joyce, is give you a call back because our phone connection is pretty bad.
Okay.
So hold on there, and we'll get you back on again. Joining me right now is Diane Keebler. Diane, welcome
Hello.
To Veterans Radio.
Hi. Thank you for having me, Bill.
Okay, tell me real quickly about your dad.
Okay, my father was a CB, which is the Navy Builder Group. He was a member of the 31st Naval Construction Battalion, and he was attached to the 5th Marine Division. And my father, like many of our fathers, didn't talk too much about the Battle of Iwo Jima.
No, not at 8 in the morning. They get up early.
Right, and we've got some other people on the line, it sounds like. And I haven't even put him on there yet. So your dad's name was, what was his name?
And my father's name was Arthur Keebler.
Okay, I had down A.O. Keebler, right?
Correct.
CB, and you're the one that I got the email supposed to ask you to remember to talk about the 133rd CB Battalion on Iwo Jima. And this
right.
is from John Ratomsky.
Correct. One thing, you hear a lot about the Marines and their actions, but and that was the very costly battle in Marine history, but the Iwo Jima campaign was, in fact, the most costliest battle in CB history as well. The 133rd Battalion was fully landed with the 4th Marine Division. All told, with the CB casualties amongst all the CB units in CB history, the most men lost during any CB time in World War II or even in the current days occurred in the Battle of Iwo Jima.
Well, we're going to be talking more about the Seabees because we were talking about that at breakfast. As I mentioned earlier, my partner today, Gary Lilly, is a Navy Seabee and knows quite a bit about the history of the Seabees as well. Also joining us on the line right now is Mike Yellen. Mike, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hi, Dale. Good morning.
How are you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm terrific. Thank you very much. Tell me a little bit about your dad's experiences on Imo.
Sure. So my dad, Jerry Yellen, was a P-51 fighter pilot who landed on the island 2 or 3 weeks after the battle began and after the airstrip was secure. And he, you know, was a fighter pilot and helped, you know, strafe and bomb the front line in support of the Marines.
Right. And I'm going to get back to Jerry Yellen. Jerry has been on our program a couple of times. You've written a couple of books about his experiences there, and it's a fascinating story. And finally, on joining us on Veterans Radio is John Butler. And John, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, okay, I my hearing isn't great, and I should have done something about it. But anyway, I got you, and I'm right here.
All right, tell me, John, about if your hearing's like mine. I'll try and talk louder.
Yeah.
So tell me about a little bit about your experiences with Iwo Jima.
Well, my father commanded the 1st Battalion, 27th Marines. I was 5 years old when the 27th Marines left, they went to Hawaii. They left in August of 44 after training intensely at Camp Pendleton. And I guess I've been connected to that battalion the rest of my life. They landed in the assault on Red Beach 2. Their objective was to secure the southern end of the airfield. On their right flank was the 4th Division, and the anyway, on D-Day, they were the only Marine unit to get a piece of the airfield. Of course, they had heavy casualties doing so. Amongst one of those casualties, taking that southern end of the airfield, was John Bassalone, famous Marine,
right,
who has been depicted and honored in the Marine Corps forever. And anyway, they fought on and fought in the Battle of Hill 362A. They suffered tremendous casualties there and finished the battle. My father was killed on D-plus 14. He was an up-front type leader, and over the years I've been connected to him, to his men. A lot of the officers and men that served in that outfit maintained contact, and I guess we're all blood brothers still. But so I have a very strong and emotional connection to the Battle of Iwo Jima. And I met Diane, actually, one of her father's friends who was a CB, who was from New Orleans, my father's native place, noted his cross in the Marine Cemetery there and put a crucifix on it and took a picture. And Diane had that photo in her collection, and through Chuck Tatum, a machine gunner who wrote a book about it, Red Blood, Black Sand, she found my phone number and called me. So Diane and I are Iwo Jima cousins. But anyway, I also traveled to Iwo Jima with her in 2005. My brother was with me also, and that was a real eventful trip for us. And anyway, over the years, I've stayed close to this association. I'm also a member of the 5th Marine Division Association, and Iwo Jima has loomed large in my life. So that pretty much sums it up.
Okay, well, I'm going to come back to you when we talk a little bit about going back to Iwo Jima, but I want to bring Joyce back on the line. Joyce was kind of the motivation for me to do this program because I had read her book, and it really brought back a lot of memories for me. My father happened to be in the Coast Guard at the Battle of Iwo Jima, and his LST land was up on a beach. And if you are watching a webcast, I think we're trying to find those photos to match what we're talking about. But he was on the beach of Iwo Jima, and he never told me a word about it until I found an album, actually a couple of years ago, that he had put together, and he had all these official Navy photos that were of the Battle of Iwo Jima, and he never said a word about this. And Joyce, did your dad ever talk about it, or how did you get involved in Iwo Jima?
Well, my dad, from the time I was very little, perhaps my earliest memories are going through a book sitting in his lap, and he would tell me about his friends. However, when I was 10 years old, he had what they called a nervous breakdown back then,
mm-hmm.
and now we're pretty sure it was PTSD. But they took him to the hospital, and they gave him shock treatments. And when he came home, he couldn't stop talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of the information that's in the book, aside from the research that I did to verify certain things, I treated it as historical fiction. But it's essentially his memories of his friends and what happened to them on the island. He happened to be there all 36 days. And his unit, his squad, was killed off to a man except for him twice. So he had a lot of very ambivalent memories. He was very proud to be there, but he had all of these amazing stories. The one that I always remember significantly is when they raised the flag on Suribachi. All of the ships and boats all around started blowing their horns, and everybody for a moment thought the battle was over and stopped to look. And, of course, at that moment, the snipers took advantage, and he lost one of his very dear friends that moment. So it was a very ambivalent, bittersweet moment for him. And, of course, that's such a famous, iconic image that was kind of burned into my head probably about 10 and a half, 11, when he was telling me that particular story.
Yeah, it's very interesting that you mentioned that about 10 years old or so. When I was 10 years old, we went to Washington, D.C. on the way for a family vacation, and we stopped at the Marine Memorial with the raising of the flag there. And he never said a word, but he made a big deal out of our having to go and see this, and he just stood staring at it. And you just wonder what was going through his mind if he was, time tripping all the way back to that moment when that flag went up and what they had to go through. I want to go over to Diane right now. And Diane, we're talking to Diane Keebler, and we're talking to the sons and daughters of Iwo Jima and trying to find out how the battle not only affected their fathers but also affected their lives. So, Diane, you mentioned earlier that your father was a CB. And he was on the island building, trying to rebuild the airfields?
Yes. My father went in from what I can determine, about D+4. And stayed on the island until mid-October, and he had enough points that he was able to return stateside. Interesting, Dale and Joyce, what you said about the Iwo Jima Memorial. Like you, about 10 years old, my mother had given me a steel bracelet which was made from wrecked Japanese aircraft that my dad had made for her on Iwo Jima. And this was before the POW bracelets of the Vietnam War, and she gave it to me. And it had her name on it, a little etched outline of the island. And she gave that to me. And I think that's when I decided I want to go everywhere where my father went on Iwo Jima. So that was my inspiration. And like you two other kids of Iwo Jima, on my first trip to Washington, D.C., I was with my mom in my sixth grade my sixth grade class. And we drove at the memorial. And I remember my mother breaking down in tears, and she didn't say a word either about that. I knew Dad was on Iwo, but I clearly remember her just kind of losing it on her last trip to Washington, D.C.
We never really appreciate what our moms went through during World War II itself, and it's almost unfortunately they're all passing away also. And I think we need to do a program on the women left behind and how did they cope and so on, because it's really, I found it to be really interesting. And I've mentioned this before in our program, is, you know, that my mom went through World War II, and then I go out to Vietnam, and I'm wondering, how did she survive mentally and emotionally? And, you know, I was just oblivious to the whole thing. Anyhow, but I digress as usual. Getting back to what we're talking about here, I want to bring on Mike Yellen. Mike, I want you to tell me, tell our audience what your dad was doing at Iwo Jima.
So, as I said, he was a fighter pilot, landed 2 or 3 weeks after the battle began, and strafed the front lines in support of the Marines, and then once the island was captured and was in full control, he then flew combat missions escorting bombers over Japan on their bombing raids.
And he came back with some problems of his own, didn't he?
He sure did, and it's really striking the similarities of the stories that I hear from the other participants on the call. He came back. He never talked about it, and you know, until fairly recently, he kept it all within him. But he too is now understood, suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder, and it's really interesting to think about, you know, how that affected his life. And he, you know, had multiple different jobs, and he was you know, the way he describes it now, he was never really content and lost, and you know, had, you know, these hidden images that he didn't really share with us at all, and it must have really affected his life, that if he hadn't fought in that battle and been there, you know, it might have been a very different life for him. He might have gone on to college, and he's a very bright man and a very driven man. I think he would have been a great doctor or a lawyer, and it just didn't turn out like that. So it's who knows, but certainly that experience did a great, you know, shaped his life greatly.
Well, it certainly does. And in talking with your dad at one of the Military Writers Society's conferences that I've been to, you find that many of the concerns and issues — Gary doesn't like when I use issues — well, with some of the issues that he was talking about, it's like, oh, I know exactly what he's talking about here, with you know, that not being content with a particular job or not necessarily getting along with authority figures, let's put it that way.
Right. one of his first jobs when he came back was to fly a commercial airline, and he was a P-51 fighter pilot, and they put him in a commercial airline with very little training, and it took him 7 or 8 hours to fly from New York to Florida, and he was really bored with it, and plus didn't have the right kind of training, was afraid he was going to crash, so he got out of that job very quickly.
Yeah. Get frustrated very easily at some of the things. But what I wanted to talk to Michael about with Jerry was kind of his epiphany, and your brother had a lot to do with that epiphany that your father had. Could you tell us that story?
So there are actually two sort of epiphanies. One is everybody has said already, their fathers kept this secret, you know, untold for the most part. And he really had an epiphany. We had gone to see the movie Platoon. And if you remember, mm-hmm. At the end of the movie Platoon, they're bulldozing bodies into a mass grave.
Right.
He came out of that movie hysterically crying, saying that's what his memories of Iwo Jima were. And that was sort of the first time he really even talked about it. And from that point on, it sort of opened up his ability to talk about it, and he's written about it, and he's talked about it, and you know, these days that's really, you know, now he's 87 years old, he talks about it a lot. So that's one epiphany. The other is, yes, my brother, for, you know, complicated long story reasons, ended up living in Japan, moving to Japan, a country where my father, you know, hated the people, despised the people for their attack on America. And ended up marrying a Japanese woman, and he traveled there, met the people, met the people of Japan, met obviously his my brother's in-laws, and fell in love and an appreciation for his former enemies that he now writes, you know, and talks about a lot, and it's changed his outlook on life and how former enemies can become family, basically.
We've had a couple of experiences like that on Veterans Radio. We're talking with the sons and daughters of the veterans of Iwo Jima and how Iwo Jima affected their dads and how it really ended up affecting our lives in the same thing. Gary went back to Vietnam and came back with the realization that it's a country, not a war anymore, and that the people were, you know, friendly and all the things that most human beings are. And it was really kind of eye-opening to all of us when he was telling that story. And I think it sounds very similar, that you realize that it is it's a country, and that we have to, you know, separate the two as we move forward in our lives. I want to move on to John just a moment, because John, your dad died on Iwo Jima, and you mentioned the camaraderie of the people that kind of came around your life after you started finding out more and more about him. Can you talk about that just a little bit?
Yes. My father, of course, he was a battalion commander, and he was extremely well-liked and respected by his men. He fought right through to the 14th day. He commanded the battalion from the time it was formed. And after he was killed, he was very prominent in our lives. My mother... he was the love of her life, and she's living now in the punch.
Vital database has been updated.
In any case, she never knew the fact that he was, you know, he did what he did and was the man he was, and he was very prominent in our lives. And as a young boy, I had received copies of the Spearhead, which was the history of the 5th Marine Division. I think I had read that from cover to cover when I was about 11 years old or 10 when it first came out. And I went in the Marine Corps, and one occasion there, one of the men that had served with him saw my name and hunted me down to tell me about my dad. And a frontline visit that my dad made to his position when he was a young Marine sitting in a foxhole on a listening post, and my dad was inspecting the lines. And anyway, he got a hold of me at Camp Lejeune, and then over the years, of course, my mother had letters, all kinds of letters, and some on and off contact with a number of the officers and people that had served with him. And we were able to renew those through these reunions. The first one I attended was in 1990 in New Orleans, where my father was from, and all his uncles took my mom, and there was a handful, quite a few of the 1st Battalion guys there, including Chuck Tatum, who wanted to write a book about his experiences there, and I offered to help him, and I did. And it just, you know, over the years I've gotten to know, I'd say close to 24 of these men or met them, and it's been a real value and for me personally. Of course, I traveled when I was in the Marine Corps. When I was with FMF back, Father Paul Bradley, who was a well-known Catholic chaplain, was still on active duty, and they had a flight to Iwo Jima in February of 1965, right before Vietnam started heating up quite a bit. Anyway, Father Bradley got me on the flight with him and a handful of other Marine veterans, and we flew to the island. That was my first visit. And, of course, I had the second visit there in 2005. But so Iwo Jima's just been a big part of my life, and the men that fought there, particularly those in my dad's outfit. And
I'm sure that it is. It's amazing what a large family that the military really is.
Well, it is. It's a Marine Corps family, and you know of course I'm a kind of a prejudicial Marine. I mean, it is a Sunday.
That's true. I'm going to have to cut you off right now, John. I'll be right back with you. We're going to go to the bottom of the hour to our Medal of Honor segment this week. It's going to be a little bit different. I'm going to read, as I mentioned earlier, On Iwo Jima, there were 27 Medal of Honors medals awarded. 22 were presented to the Marines, and 5 were presented to United States Navy sailors. That's a full 30% of the 82 Medal of Honors that were awarded to the Marines during the entirety of World War II. Think about that in our audience. 27 or 22 out of 82 were on one battle. So this kind of gives you an idea of how ferocious it was. I'm just going to read off the names, and if you're watching on the webcast, we're going to be trying to show the pictures as we go along. Starting off, number one, Charles Berry, Marine Corps, and a corporal in the Marine Corps. William Caddy, Private First Class, Marine Corps. Justice Chambers, Lieutenant Colonel, Marine Corps Reserve. Darrell Cole, Sergeant, Marine Corps Reserves. Robert Dunlap, Captain, Marine Corps Reserves. Ross Gray, Sergeant, Marine Corps Reserve. William Harrell, Sergeant, Marine Corps. Rufus Herring, United States Navy, Lieutenant, Junior Grade. Douglas Jacobson, Marine Corps Reserve, Private First Class. Joseph Julian, Marine Corps Reserve, Platoon Sergeant. James LaBelle, Marine Corps, Private First Class. John Leams, Second Lieutenant, Marine Corps Reserves. Jacqueline Harold Lucas, Private First Class, Marine Corps Reserves. Jack Loomis, First Lieutenant, Marine Corps Reserve. Harry Martin, Marine Corps Reserves, First Lieutenant. Joseph McCarthy, Captain, Marine Corps Reserve. George Phillips, Private, Marine Corps Reserves. Francis Pierce, Pharmacist Mate, First Class, Navy. Donald Rule, Private First Class, Marine Corps Reserves. Franklin Ziegler, Private, Marine Corps Reserves. Tony Stein, Corporal, Marine Corps Reserves. George Whalen, Pharmacist Mate, Second Class, United States Navy. William Walsh, Gunnery Sergeant, Marine Corps Reserves. Wilson Watson, Private, Marine Corps Reserves. Herschel Williams, Corporal, Marine Corps Reserves. Jack Williams, Pharmacist Mate, Third Class, United States Navy. John Willis, Pharmacist Mate, First Class, United States Navy. The other one on the Iwo Jima was Don Basilone, as someone mentioned earlier, was a Medal of Honor recipient who was killed on Iwo Jima, who had received a Medal of Honor for his bravery at Guadalcanal. The Medal of Honor is brought to you this week by the American House, homes in Michigan. And for more information on the American House, you can go to AmericanHouse.com. We'll be right back.
Stripes on Iwo Jima Isle, through the blood and tears they won through. Bless the heart of each Yankee there on Iwo Jima Isle, rest beneath the blanket of...
Now, I bet you don't know where we found that song. We're back on Veterans Radio, and we're talking with the sons and daughters of the veterans of Iwo Jima. And I didn't realize I was going to get quite as emotional reading those names of the Medal of Honor recipients. It's just amazing. And obviously, many, many of them were posthumously awarded. But if you get the opportunity out there to our civilian audience or any audience, if you go to the Medal of Honor website, it will has a list of every one of them. There's been 3,400 Medal of Honor recipients throughout the history of our country. And they're just amazing what these men have done to protect themselves, to protect their unit, to finish their mission. And some of them, they're so young. It's just, it takes my breath away when I read their citations. But if you, it's something I find really interesting to look at. As I mentioned before, we're talking with the sons and daughters of the veterans of Iwo Jima. I'm going to ask Joyce to come back on. Joyce?
I'm here.
I know. When you were talking about writing your book in the shadow of Suribachi, the stories were amazing in that book. As you mentioned, it was fictionalized, but boy, I'll tell you what, you did a really good job of making it feel very real.
Thank you.
Have, Have you run into some of your friends of your dad over the years?
I have never met a Marine at the battle who knew Dad there. And I have asked. I have gone around. However, I have talked with many Marines who not only were in similar units, but basically could have seen every step along the way the same things that Dad did. And in particular, when I was writing Suribachi, I posted to a Marine Corps bulletin board, and it was amazing how many of the guys contacted me. And one gentleman in particular said, I can't tell you my story. I've not told anyone my story. But I'll give you the background information. So he did. You know, I wanted to know what was in the backpacks and, you know, basic detail kind of things. And then he wanted to read it. And after he read it, he called me, and he said, I've already been to the shrink, and the shrink has this idea that maybe you could put me in there, and I can tell my story, and then my family can read it, but they won't know which one is me.
Oh, right. That is so similar. Joyce's father is Billy Ray Plummer.
Billy Lee Plummer.
Billy Lee, I'm sorry. And I knew it was a nice Yankee name.
Yeah.
Well, one of the pictures that Joyce sent me, that is on a webcast, is of your dad in basic training. You look like he's about 12.
Exactly. He was 17 when he was in basic training there, and he was. It was a very strange situation for him because his brother had just been killed in New Guinea. And so my grandmother had to sit through 36 days of the Battle of Iwo Jima, and this was a time where they were publishing pictures of it and stories about it in the newspaper and on the radio every day. And she had just lost one son, and then she had Daddy, who, as you say, looks like he was maybe 12, and she had to wait knowing that she wouldn't hear from him for many a long time, just waiting for the battle to end. I can't imagine, as you said about your mother, I can't imagine what a 36-day battle must feel like to a mother who's already lost a son
and
has left five hands.
I can't either. And I'm trying to look. I was going back through my list here. You mentioned that your dad was only 17 years old, and one of these Medal of Honor recipients was the youngest one, and he was only 17. Jacqueline Lucas. Right.
Yeah. My dad was familiar with that story. In fact, that's the earliest story. Before he started telling me specifically about his closest friends, he told me about Jack Lucas, and that what happened was they were throwing grenades.
Mm-hmm.
And Jack Lucas, he said he was just a little bitty old kid, like Daddy was very old, you know.
Right, yeah.
But they threw the grenade, and Jack Lucas grabbed the grenade and put him underneath his body.
And he survived.
He survived. Exactly.
He
recently died, yeah.
Right. He turned 17 5 days before the Iwo Jima D-Day invasion. I've got students younger than that. That's frightening.
It is. It's very shocking. And, you know, for these guys, they were very bonded to each other. And the one thing that Daddy always would repeat is that his sergeant was maybe 22, so he was really old.
Mm-hmm.
But he reminded him of his big brother who had died.
Oh.
And so he was very bonded to this sergeant. And, of course, and then the sergeant would say, you know, stick with me, keep your eyes on me, we'll do fine. As long as you can see me, you'll do fine. And, of course, the moment he stepped on the beach, he was killed. So there was a sense of disorientation for all of these very young boys. And someone was telling me that in later years, when they were in officers' training school, there were stories and videos talked about these young men who were on Iwo, who were, you know, suddenly leaderless, and how they reacted and how they dealt with the situation and how they found new leadership and how new leaders were sent in. And it's kind of an iconic story of how they survived.
It is. Gary had a question that he wanted to ask.
Well, it's not a question. It's just a little story. Joe Rodriguez, who was in lived in Ann Arbor, was in the squad that raised the flag. He wasn't in the photo. He was picking up rocks to block it up with. But he talked. Mm-hmm. He would talk, and he would always cry when he talked about the guys with him. And it was on a battle before Iwo Jima that he always talked about this young kid named Peaches, and whether he said he looked 16 or was 16, but I know he wasn't older than 17, jumped on a grenade. And they called him Peaches because he couldn't grow a beard. He just had a little fuzz there. Jumped on a grenade to save everybody. The grenade didn't go off, but then Peaches was killed 3 days later in the battle. I'll never forget watching Joe tell the story with tears streaming down his cheeks.
Well, I think that you find that these men were so bonded together because they spent so much time together. It's almost like I'm a little jealous of them. I know that sounds strange, but in other wars, or especially in the Vietnam War, we rotated in and out on an individual basis, so you never really were able to establish, at least where I was, the camaraderie or the closeness that these men had during World War II. I'm amazed how they remember when they do start talking. They do remember details of everything. Diane, I want to bring you back on for just a moment. We got about three more minutes before we take another break to talk about the CBs. And there was one story that I heard about, and I don't know if your father had told you this story about the V-29 that came into Iwo.
There were a number of these 29s that landed on Iwo. Are you talking about the first one, the dynamite that landed on March 4th?
All right, yeah, the first one.
I didn't hear that specific story. As I say, my father never talked, but in general, the CBs were frequently working on the airstrips as the planes were landing. And when I went to one of my dad's reunions, my father passed away in 1999, and never went to any of his reunions because he and my mom had retired out of state and stuff, but his shipmates cordially invited me to attend one of the CB reunions, and a story came out about a B-29 crashing in April of 1944, killing a CB in the unit. And one of the veterans who was there told the story about that, and it had never been told to anybody before. So I think the CBs were in harm's way, not only when, because many of them landed early, but this gentleman, George Young, who has since passed away, told the story of how his life was spared and how Meeker was killed on the airstrip when a B-29 hit the truck that they were in. It's a telling story because there was the foxhole mate of the man who was killed, a man from Texas, was there and had never heard the details of how his buddy was killed.
All right, that happens. Gary, you had another question?
Another little story that Joe Rodriguez told. He was on the side of Mount Suribachi before they raised the flag and looked in, and he said the CBs were working already on the runway, even though the Marines were still fighting the Japanese on one end of it. And they looked up,
true,
and here came a B-29. The CBs had their dozers out there repairing the runway. They pulled off the side of the runway while the B-29 came skidding in, and he said as it skidded past them, the bulldozer was right back out there on the runway patching, leveling it again. You go about what the CBs, the bravery of those guys, too.
Well, I'm proud to be a CB daughter because I have to say, out of all the veterans that I meet, everybody loves the CBs. The Marines love them because the CBs gave them food. The mm-hmm. Army Air Corps pilots love the CBs because they built their airstrips. So I'm very proud of that. And Gary will tell you the same thing. CBs are liked by every unit because while they're out there doing their job, they also like to make life comfortable for everybody.
That's true. We're going to take another break. We'll be right back after these messages. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
Veterans, need help with your VA benefit claim? Then call Legal Help for Veterans right now at 800-693-4800. To ensure the best possible chance for success, our attorneys at Legal Help for Veterans are devoted to VA claim appeals, and they will forcefully present your particular case. So make that call today to Legal Help for Veterans at 800-693-4800 for your no-charge consultation.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
Taking a sentimental journey today. We're talking with the sons and daughters of veterans of Iwo Jima. We've been talking with Joyce Faulkner, whose father was a Marine, Diane Keebler, whose father was a Navy CB, Mike Yellen, whose dad was a pilot in the Army Air Corps, and John Butler, whose father was a commander in the Marines and died, unfortunately, on Iwo Jima. I'm really pleased with the stories that we're getting out here, and it's just to talk about these things, because if we don't keep these stories going, they're just going to fade away, and we don't want them to fade away. They're much too important to talk about. Mike, I want to bring you back on for a second, because you were one of the ones that also made a trip back to Iwo Jima with your dad, didn't you?
I did. Last year at this time, I was very fortunate to be able to go back with my father to Iwo Jima, the first time that he had been back since the war ended. And it was a very emotional, moving, poignant experience for me, and you know, multiply that by many fold for him. It's just a real unique experience.
Can you, any one of you can jump in here with this question? How big is Iwo Jima?
It's 7.5 square miles.
7.5 square miles. That's not very big when you think about it. And
no, when you think about there are about 60,000 Marines involved and 21,000 Japanese defenders, and I don't know how many planes were taking off, but it was an enormously densely populated with incredibly brave fighters on both sides.
Well, I can imagine.
And Diane, just summarily, it was probably the most dense battlefield in all of World War II, just by the nature of the Japanese defenses and the congregation of men that we needed to subdue those defenses. There's probably a few battlefields that had as many men crowded, and that both of them heavily armed. The Japanese were had an extreme amount of heavy ordnance, of mortars and artillery, and what struck me on my visit was particularly on Red Beach 2, when my dad landed it up on Moriyama Airfield, where our guide, John Ripley, took us, was the amount of shrapnel still on the ground. You know, 60 years after the battle, just everywhere you look, you picked up shrapnel. I have a handful of it here I brought back with me, and you wonder how anybody on a darn island didn't get hit.
Yeah, you do wonder when you think about that, when that occurs. Going back to Mike real quickly, you were on the island with your brother and your dad, weren't you?
Right, my brother and his 18-year-old son.
Oh, okay. So the generations were there.
Correct.
That must have been really exciting and interesting for your nephew.
You know, he's a shy Japanese teenager. Didn't talk too much about it. For my dad, you know, the tears were streaming down his cheeks the moment he walked off the airplane, and I felt the emotion too.
Diane, I want to come back to you, because you sent me the next picture of the memorial that was built on the island, and you have been there, correct?
Yes, I've been there four times.
Wow. So tell me a little bit about this memorial, because it was kind of an unusual memorial.
Well, there's a memorial, and the picture's up on the website now, that was built by the 31st Naval Construction Battalion. The memorial was dedicated October 2nd, 1945, and as you can see on the website, there is a 48-star bronze frieze that's in the monument now. When the island was returned to Japan in 1968, there was just a regular flagpole with an American flag flying atop that monument. However, you don't fly a flag on Japanese homeland, and it was their island, which was returned by treaty agreement. So part of the arrangement was that a flag be incorporated in the monument that was originally built in 1945, so that there's always an Old Glory atop of Mount Suribachi.
And isn't there something?
And it was, as it say, built by the Seabees, and it's one of those things. When I went back, my father's shipmates wanted to know, is that memorial still there, and what does it look like, and please give them photographs of it and everything. Mm-hmm. And it's the sort of memorial that most of the people who fought on the island in 1945 never got a chance to see it, and a lot of them don't even know that it's there.
Well, it wasn't it made of some of the materials that were left over on the island?
Right. In the center of the monument is kind of a bas-relief of the Rosenthal photograph, and the 31st CB, some of the men in the unit, gathered the wrecked Japanese aircraft, and they built a forge, and they cast this bronze tableau that's in the center of the memorial, which is kind of very fitting. And also, too, the inscriptions, which you can't really read, it says it's dedicated to all who served on Iwo Jima.
And there's also a cemetery on Iwo Jima, isn't that correct?
Well, there were actually three cemeteries that were built by the Seabees in time back in 1945. The 3rd and 4th Marine Division cemeteries were built by the 133rd, and the 5th Marine Division cemetery was built by my dad's unit, the 31st. However, in 1947, the remains were being repatriated for burial either in the Punch Bowl in Hawaii or at the family's request, perhaps in the hometown.
Okay.
So there are no American cemeteries on Iwo Jima, because that was foreign territory.
Okay.
So you would want your father's, uncle's, brother's.
Right, one of the first pictures that I found that we're looking at right now was of one of the cemeteries that was there, and I thought, oh,
that's
powerful
probably the
that
third
was.
That's probably the 3rd or the 4th Marine Division mm-hmm. cemetery, and I can recognize that because of the shape of the headstones.
I want to remind our audience that once the program is over, that the webcast is going to be archived on our website. You'll just be able to click in where it says Watch Veterans Radio Live, and usually within 3 or 4 minutes, the video part anyway is archived right there, and you'll be able to click on it and look at some of the photos that we've got up there. I think it's a great addition. I try not to get distracted by looking at them myself, because then I forget what the heck I'm supposed to be doing here. But so you can do that, and also the audio portion of the program will be archived later on today on our website. Just click on Go to Our Archives, and it will be there. I want to go to my final question as we're coming up to the end of the hour, which is always a thing that's just so annoying about live radio. You just want to go on for hours to talk about these things. Is what are your thoughts of Iwo Jima today? And I'm going to start off with Joyce.
Well, as you mentioned earlier, that my whole life has been Iwo Jima. And I too have a little bracelet like Diane talked about, made from a plane. My writing, the first story when I retired that I wanted to do was to write these stories down before I forgot them. And there's a picture of my book online now, and the picture of those guys. And they were, you know, they didn't grow up to get married and have children. And they didn't, right now their parents are gone and their siblings are dying. And my dad's memories of them were the legacy that he gave to me that I wanted to get into that book.
Mm-hmm.
And now that I've found Diane and John and Mike and all of these other people that have similar lives, it's kind of reassuring that I'm not the only one with this fear that what all they did there will be forgotten.
Right, absolutely. All right, Diane?
I have to agree with Joyce. I think for me, had my father talked, I wouldn't have been so doggedly determined to do this research and to wonder how. And to me, the most satisfying thing was to find John Butler and give him the photograph that I had had for years. And I think there is that bond between us Iwo Jima kids and each other, very much like what our fathers had on that island and during the whole time of World War II. And we have to take those values and live them and share them.
Right. I absolutely agree. Mike, tell me a little bit about what you're thinking right now.
Yeah, no, I share everybody else's feelings. The battle there was such an indelible mark on my father and the other participants' fathers, and it's something that is passed down to, you know, the next generation. And I agree. I think it's very important to carry that forward and what was done there for the sake of the country. And the sacrifice that was made there, you know, was incredible. And to be a part of it vicariously through my father and all of our fathers is a emotional thing.
It is amazing. John, I'm afraid I'm going to have to cut you off here. We know how you feel.
Yeah.
Your life has been affected probably much or
I
more.
I just have one quick comment.
One quick comment.
Yeah, just within the circle of the sons and daughters and, of course, the Marine Corps, Iwo Jima is forever a legacy. But programs like yours will extend that, what happened there, to a wider audience, and I hope that is accomplished.
Thank you.
The nation needs to never forget what happened at Iwo Jima.
Absolutely. Thank you all so very much for being on Veterans Radio. Until next week with another thrilling story of America's veterans, you are dismissed.
Not all views and opinions expressed on Veterans Radio reflect the views of Veterans Radio or your local station.
Veterans, need help with your VA benefit claim? Then call Legal Help for Veterans right now at 800-693-4800. To ensure the best possible chance for success, our attorneys at Legal Help for Veterans are devoted to VA claim appeals, and they will forcefully present your particular case. So make that call today to Legal Help for Veterans at 800-693-4800 for your no-charge consultation.